From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we continue our end-of-the-year series, Last Laughs, featuring some of our most entertaining interviews of the past year. We'll hear from two comics today. Mort Saul will tell us how he created a new kind of comedy based on the headlines of the day, not one-liners. He was so popular that in 1960, he became the first comic to appear on the cover of Time magazine. Also, we'll hear from Dave Chappelle, who describes his Comedy Central program as America's number one source for offensive comedy. Tonight, Comedy Central is running a Chappelle marathon. Last Laughs coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush said today that Secretary of State Colin Powell will lead a delegation of experts to the areas hit by Sunday's earthquake and tsunami in the Indian Ocean. The group will assess the need for long-term U.S. assistance. The delegation will include the president's brother, Florida Governor Jeb Bush, who has experience with disaster recovery after the hurricane damage to his state. The death toll from the disaster now stands at more than 117,000. Disaster officials say as many as 5 million survivors of the tsunami are now without the basic needs for staying alive, including food, shelter, and medical care. The United Nations says aid contributions for tsunami victims have now reached $500 million. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
World Bank President James Wolfensohn told the UN in a conference call that the bank would offer $250 million, that doubles the world's financial contribution so far. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan says the response has been good, adding governments have indicated they will do more to deal with the long-term consequences.
No one agency or one country can deal with it alone. We need to coordinate our efforts and pool our efforts to have maximum impact.
Annan, who cut short his vacation, spoke with Secretary of State Colin Powell and other members of a core group of donor nations that the U.S. set up. The Bush administration has pledged $35 million and is sending in military ships and helicopters. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Health South has agreed to pay the government $325 million to settle charges it overbilled Medicare and other government health care programs. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
The settlement comes in a lawsuit brought by a Texas Medicare recipient who noticed HealthSouth was charging the agency for physical therapy he never received. Several other whistleblowers joined in a lawsuit under the Federal False Claims Act, which allows citizens to recover money for the government. The Birmingham-based company is the nation's largest rehabilitation services firm. It's at the center of a larger criminal probe into an alleged $2.6 billion scheme to inflate the company's earnings. 17 former HealthSouth executives have been indicted in the accounting scandal, including founder and former chief executive officer Richard Scrushy. He goes on trial next month in Birmingham. Scrushy has pleaded not guilty to 58 charges of accounting fraud. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
Stock prices showed little change today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 28 points to close at 10,800 in very light trading of just over 800 million shares. Advances led declines by about 9 to 7. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 1 point to close at 2178. The S&P 500 remained steady at 1213. This is NPR News. Spain's government has approved legislation that would allow same-sex marriage in that country. The legislation would make Spain the third country in the world to do so, after the Netherlands and Belgium. Jerome Sokolowski reports from Madrid.
The legislation is one of the cornerstones of the Spanish government's social reforms. Since taking office last spring, socialist Prime Minister José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero has steered Spain drastically to the left. He's making abortion and divorce easier and has authorized embryonic stem cell research. The same-sex marriage bill will allow homosexual couples to adopt children. It must still go before Parliament, but it's expected to pass without difficulty, and gays and lesbians could marry as early as this spring. The legislation shows how much Spain has changed in the nearly 30 years since the end of the Franco dictatorship. Before that, under General Franco, homosexuals were thrown in jail. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Sokolovsky in Madrid.
Christine Gregoire has been officially certified the winner of the governor's race in Washington State. A hand recount showed that Gregoire, a Democrat, defeated Republican Dino Rossi by just 129 votes. Rossi won the original count by 261 votes and prevailed in a machine recount by 42. Rossi said it's possible that Republicans will still contest the election in the courts. He cited a Republican claim that a discrepancy of more than 3,500 votes has been found in King County, which includes the Democratic stronghold of Seattle. Republicans have until January 22nd to make a complaint. Gregoire is scheduled to be sworn in as governor on January 12th. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo USA, helping feed the 35 million people in the U.S. at risk of hunger through initiatives such as the Campus Kitchens Project at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're ending the year with our series Last Laughs, featuring some of our most entertaining interviews of the past year. 1 year ago, I spoke to Mort Saul on the 50th anniversary of his first performance at the San Francisco nightclub, The Hungry Eye. That's where Saul created a new kind of comedy, topical and conversational. As the critic Francis Davis wrote, quote, Saul was the most innovative comedian to gain access to a mass audience in the comedy happy 50s. Lenny Bruce was still doing shtick when Saul began walking on stage with a newspaper, extemporaneously riffing on the headlines. A cool jazz buff, Saul derived from musicians not only his timing, but also their habit of traveling light. Schnooky dialects and comic personas, like the ones Bruce was still hiding behind, would have been excess baggage for Saul, who spoke to audiences in his natural voice. Unquote. Saul was the first comic to make a live recording, the first to do college concerts, to speak at the National Press Club, or to be on the cover of Time magazine. Most of today's political and topical comics owe something to Mort Saul. He's still performing. Let's start with an excerpt of his album, A Way of Life, recorded in 1960, the same year he was on the cover of Time.
I want to read you part of the San Francisco Chronicle, which I have here. And there's a couple of interesting things happen you might be interested in, having to do with Billy Graham, who called me an atheist. You know about this? Yeah, he called me an atheist, which is not true. And as I've pointed out in the past, very few people are really atheists, you know. And Billy Graham, it's just that I'm of another faith than Billy Graham. And almost everybody is, I find, upon inspection. So, Zen Buddhism. So, the club is supposed to be empty. The owners were worried because of this high holiday. So, did I tell you about that? That's what I kept saying. So, it has to do with ethnic groups, which I want to discuss after a while. Right? So anyway, now, so I get back to that. So this gets better. So then he said I'm an atheist, and I pointed out I'm not, and the most people past college age are not really atheists because it's too hard to be in society, for one thing, and because you don't get any days off. That's been my big thing. If you're an agnostic, you don't know whether you get them off or not. That's it. Monday. This is really weird. So then he attacked me, and Billy Graham is in Melbourne, Australia, saving Melbourne. That's his big thing, you know, he saves cities. And I don't doubt that. It's sincerity involved. It's just, you know, if he really wanted a challenge, he could go to Vegas. Wouldn't that be great? Saving, well, anyway, thank you. So now, to get back to
Mort Saul told me that 50 years ago, he started to click with his audience when he took an anti-authority position.
The blacklist was on then. Not that it isn't on now. And it was the Russians were provoking us, you know, at every turn in Berlin and all. And I pointed out to the audience that every time the Russians threw an American in jail, we would throw an American in jail to show them they can't get away with it. And I found the oppressed majority, as Adlai Stevenson pointed out, which were the Democrats who were all around and thought that it was the conformist 50s and they weren't welcome. But a lot of this sounds innocuous now, you know, like General Motors might become resentful and cut the government off without a cent. See, there wasn't a Ralph Nader then, and there weren't any kids, you know. And everybody remembers what they wanted to. People remembered the political stuff. Woody Allen, whom I saw Sunday, said to me he remembered all the stuff about men and women. I used to get up and, you know, quote Shaw, who said, a woman who demands her equality renounces her superiority, and a lot of Freud. And so it was, don't be ashamed to be intellectually curious. That's what it was about.
So before you performed at the Hungry Eye, had you performed anyplace else before?
Yeah, in Los Angeles. I was trying to get started for about 2 years, very unsuccessfully.
What were you doing before when you were in L.A.?
Oh, imitations of movie stars and anti-authoritarian stuff about people and policemen, mostly about being a misfit in society, which, of course, makes you everybody. So there was no success here. The city was unconscious. May still be.
Were you doing
as far as they...
Were you doing James Cagney impressions like every other comic?
No. It was way out stuff. You know, the cadence of political people and the president, and also the sense of what they said, more than an impression. I mean, in the sense, well, let me give you an example. Here was Johnson. Later, I did this, expanding the war. And the way he would do it, as he established a draft and a democracy, he said, you know, it would be wonderful if the world was at peace. It would be wonderful if other countries wanted peace as much as we do. Unfortunately, they don't. Therefore, I'm sending a truck to pick up your brother in the morning. That was basically what, you know. So it was kind of looking in and saying, where are we, and does anybody else feel this way? Which is what a real performer ought to do. Does anybody else feel this way? I had the misfortune of seeing Al Franken in New York, which was presented to me as political satire, and instead of taking a swing at the mighty, he's basically lifting his leg on them. And that shows you how the franchise has degenerated. I kicked the door down hoping somebody would follow me, and we're living in a day and age where Michael Moore and Madonna are endorsing General Clark. How would you approach that as a joke? It would mean basically, and I doubt the comedians can do this today, that they see it. You know, the opportunity with this administration is so rich as an example, and where are the comedians? I mean, it's so rich. Diane Sawyer is sitting there the other night saying to Bush, what papers do you read? And the president says, I don't read papers. I've got people working for me that know everything. He doesn't read papers. I mean, you know, it's like my conversation with him when he said, you've got to fight the war on terror. Are you ready to make the sacrifices? And I said, I don't know. I'm pretty exhausted from fighting communism with your father. And he said to me, well, I don't like it. It's a dirty job, but that's what you elected me to do. And, of course, I was tempted to say, we didn't elect you that much. But I knew him when he was the governor.
Well, you know, while we're on the subject, what about, say, Bill Maher, who does a lot of political comedy on television?
Well, a lot of it is profane, which is not to my taste. But you can't have an elite feeling toward the people.
Do you think he does?
Yeah, I think he does. I think the skepticism toward authority, you know, this is all said from a salon at Arianna Huffington's house. And I don't have a feeling that that's a real rebellion. I'm being very candid with you.
Yeah, but you were connected to power, too. I mean, you worked for the Kennedy campaign writing for him. And
yes, I did.
You knew, and still know a lot of very powerful people.
I also sat head-to-head with Kennedy and argued about Fidel Castro and the revolution. But what I'm saying to you is what Stanley Scheinbaum said. These people have no politics. They're basically skeptical about America. They think Southerners are ignorant. They think power necessarily corrupts. They're very elite. I've listened to Maher by the hour. When I met him, he was an announcer for Steve Allen, but I don't find any, I'm being very candid with you, I don't find any generosity of the human spirit, and I don't find a lot of talent there. We might as well be straight out. That's not Will Rogers.
Anybody you do like who's working now?
Yeah, but I'll tell you, most of the people with great humor are professional men in other fields who, as a byproduct of their viewpoint, have a sense of urban irony. Example, Alexander Haig is conducting business in Russia.
Wait a minute. You think Alexander Haig's funnier than Al Franken and Bill Moore?
I'll tell you. I can give you examples.
Okay.
And you'd be hard put to give me any examples of those two guys. Not that that's your chore. But I'm a great example. I mean, Haig said he was in Russia conducting business and how capitalism was caught on. And he said, I went to the Intercontinental Hotel in Moscow, and every car that pulled up was a Mercedes 600 driven by a Russian baby boomer with a platinum blonde 20 years old on his arm and a Rolex, and they all went in and drank apple martinis. I might as well have been in Beverly Hills, except there were no communists. That's a wonderful observation. You remember when I said to him, how can you he smokes Cuban cigars. I said, how can you smoke Fidel Castro cigars? He said, well, in my place, I prefer to think of it as burning his crops to the ground.
Wait, now let me ask you. I don't know if you politically agree with Al Haig and with the Republican administrations that he worked with. Do you have to agree politically?
Of course not.
So it's funny to you whether you agree with the person or not politically.
Yeah, because he's a man with a sense of irony. You know, I can give you an example on the other side. Gene McCarthy has the best Democratic sense of humor. The great, great humorist, poet, and thinker. And those are the people that I honor and I aspire to know. But this other stuff of rebellion by the pound, I mean, what is it? Dennis Miller is telling you how wonderful Bush is. That's not political satire.
No, I'm gonna stand up for Bill Moore and Al Franken, who I think really are funny.
Well, until you hear the real thing, you will stand up for them. But eventually, okay. You know, you won't. They're not serving. I haven't said this publicly before, but I'm glad you gave me the opportunity. They're not serving the people. A political satirist's job is to draw blood. I think what we're talking about here, even when we talk straight and the role of comedy, is that I'm not a liberal. I'm a radical. The liberals, they made liberalism into a way station for people that want to cooperate with a right-wing administration and not lose their source of income and still be self-righteous, you know, have a dinner party at Barbara Streisand's but spend an equal amount of time with the guests and out in the kitchen talking to the Nicaraguans. That's really what's going on here.
What are some of the things that you said over the years that you think drew the most blood?
Oh, my God. You know, when Kennedy was nominated, I introduced him. And I sent a wire to his father saying, you haven't lost a son, you've gained a country. You know, that kind of, but something that reflects the truth, not only the truth you find, but the truth of our fathers, and something that shows a sense of history. You know, when Jack Kennedy went to Vienna and he met, he'd only been in office 2 months, and he met Khrushchev. And he looked at this medal on his chest, and he said, what is that? He said, I won the Lenin Peace Prize. And Kennedy said, let's hope you get to keep it. We aspire to be like that. I mean, you know, and that doesn't mean I worship them. I had plenty of arguments with them. But those guys could give you 15 rounds.
My guest is Mort Saul. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mort Saul. In the 50s, he created a new kind of comedy, riffing off the headlines instead of telling one-liners. Joseph Kennedy, JFK's father, asked you to write for John Kennedy's presidential campaign.
That's right.
And you agreed to do it. Uh-huh. What did you write for him that he used?
Oh, I can give you some examples.
Good.
It was a lot of trouble about being a Catholic then. You're not old enough to remember that. But that was a bad word to run for high office. So I gave him, they come in and they say, are you going to take your orders from the Pope? And he says, it's not the hereafter that's bothering me, but November 4th is driving me out of my mind. And when he went out there at the press conference, and May Craig from the Portland Maine paper said, what are you doing for women? And he said, not enough, I'm sure. Which is, he had the quality to do it, though, you know? He had the moral authority. It was, you know, and he and I used to argue all the time because I was a friend of Adlai Stevenson.
Are there things he wrote for Kennedy that he didn't use that you remember and wish he had used?
Yeah. I did a lot of stuff about Eisenhower for him, playing golf. I said Eisenhower had hired Stevenson to write a foreign policy speech, which is true, but he couldn't use it because the language barrier was in English. And he said, I can't say that about him. And William O. Douglas, remember Justice Douglas?
Uh-huh.
Douglas was there. He said to Kennedy, listen, if you're going to be Stan Kenton, be Stan Kenton. Don't try and be Lawrence Welk. He's better at it. That's all true. You know, who could come up with that? There was great stuff. Yeah, I was, you know, and you can tell a lot about the guys about which humor they'll use and which that they get. The really heavyweight guys are never offended.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, Richard Nixon said to me, you got a chance to be Will Rogers, but you have to remember to keep a blowtorch under my behind as well as Jack Kennedy's. Even-handed.
Wait, you already had the blowtorch under his behind.
Well, he was drinking at the time.
Oh.
So, but he's the smartest guy I ever met in the office, by the way.
Oh, yeah? Did you write
brilliant.
For him, too? Would you?
No, I did not. But I worked for Reagan, who was a personal friend of mine.
So whether you agree with somebody's politics or not, if you like them personally, you'll write for them?
Yeah, you'd do some jokes. At least Reagan had a sense of humor. This guy has no sense of humor unless what he's doing now
is an example. President Bush?
Yeah. Uh-huh. He has no sense of humor. I think he knows it, too. I gave him a gag. He asked me when he was governor of Texas if he should allow prayer by the student body at the football games. And I said, it depends how far behind you are. And he wasn't sure.
I see.
Yeah. His father has a great sense of humor, uh-huh. by the way. And the old man said to me at the White House, he said to me, he asked me when I got my invitation to come to a dinner there. Mm-hmm. And I told him it had taken 4 weeks for the letter to get to California. And he said, that's absurd. And I said, how are you going to get these guys in line? Are you going to fire everybody in the post office? He said, no, I'm going to keep them on, but I'm going to mail them their checks. He's very intellectual, but he doesn't want that out, you know. So is Estes Kefauver.
Are you writing for candidates now?
No, not currently. I worked for Bill Bradley. I wrote some stuff for him. I found him... pretty cautious.
In terms of what kind of humor he'd use?
He's aloof. Well, he's aloof in general.
Uh-huh.
You know, but the most memorable things Gore has said is since he left office.
What strikes you as most memorable?
The speech about the Patriot Act, what it's costing America. But if I were writing for somebody now, as an example, you know, you'd say, you're writing for a Democrat now, you'd say, John Ashcroft's first act in his office was to come in and cover up the bare breasts of Justice out in the hall. And that's the last time Justice exposed herself in the Bush administration. That's what I would say. And then you're off, you know, you're off to the races. It's not a good sign that that they don't have any humor. On the other hand, the other night at this, I was at a dinner in New York and Lieberman was there and he quoted an old gag of mine, which is reworked Mark Twain, you know, that if you're drowning 20 feet from shore, Kissinger will throw you a 15-foot rope and Nixon will point out that they met you more than halfway. That's the, you know, you can trot out a lot of the old stuff. You know, you remember when Twain argues with his wife and she says, you'll never amount to anything. He said, well, I can always be a bad example to others. That's great American humor. That's not mean-spirited. That's not a comedian getting up and saying that the president is mindless. I mean, look at an example here. You're talking to me about Al Franken and Bill Maher and all that. What have they ever said about Cheney? I mean, wouldn't it be possible, without being intellectual, to say that Cheney is the only one covered by Bush's health plan? Or that when he dated Lynn Cheney, whom he dated, you know, in 1952 at the University of Wyoming, that he haltingly and shyly says to her, if you're free Friday, would you like to meet me at a secret underground undisclosed location? But you've got to have a point of view to do it. Otherwise, you're stealing the money. You've either got wit, or you can identify with the human heart, or you're Jackie Gleason, that you can do something. I mean, look, you know, you don't have to be an intellectual. You look back, of course, you've seen The Honeymooners, Terry,
sure,
right?
Sure, yes.
Well, look at that. That's built as well as Shakespeare. He's always got a scheme. Nobody believes in it. His wife is the first to tell him he's crazy. When he falls on his face, who comes in there and picks him up, dusts him off, and kisses him? His wife. Why do we like it? It's about something. And when somebody says to you, that's too intellectual for me, it means they don't want to work through the fact that they're stealing the money. They're not up to it.
Mort Saul, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, I'll see you in Philadelphia.
Hope so.
So long.
Mort Saul recorded 1 year ago. In January, he'll perform in three places in Florida, Sarasota, Naples, and West Palm Beach. Our end-of-the-year series, Last Laughs, continues in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publisher of Tree, A New Vision of the American Forest by photographer James Balog, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Dave Chappelle talks about his Comedy Central show and what it was like when he started his career playing clubs that catered to largely white audiences.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're ending the year with our series Last Laughs, featuring some of our most entertaining interviews of the past year. Our next guest, Dave Chappelle, has a very popular and very funny series on Comedy Central called Chappelle Show, which features stand-up, sketches, and music. In Rolling Stone magazine, Chappelle's humor was described as the edgiest, most racially charged comedy in America. The DVD of the first season became the third best-selling television DVD of all time. I spoke with Chappelle in September. What was the original concept when you first sat down to conceive of your weekly program, Chappelle Show? What did you envision it being?
The idea was that I wanted to do a variety show that was very personal, almost as if like a comedian has a joke book where he'll write his ideas down, almost as if you could bring somebody's joke book to life. And I think we were fairly successful at it in the sense that we do things on the show that are almost nightclubby. That aren't things that I'm not even used to seeing on television. It becomes whatever it needs to be.
Well, it's
one
funny.
One week it was a game show, mm-hmm. One week it's a puppet show, one week it's half documentary. You can do anything.
We know what you're talking about it being like a comic's notebook. In some of your shows, you actually set up the sketch with a story behind it, what you were thinking about before coming up with this sketch.
Right.
And that's what you did before a sketch called Racial Draft. And you explained that, you know, your wife is Asian, you're African-American. And so you've had these, like, arguments about whether Tiger Woods is black or Asian. So you came up with this show called Racial Draft. And let's hear the opening of that sketch.
Good evening and welcome to the first and maybe only racial draft here in New York City. Folks, this is for all the marbles. What happens here will state the racial standing of these Americans once and for all.
That's right. And the crowd is here to support their races.
Well, Rob, some of the biggest names in sports and in entertainment are on the line tonight, and I'm excited to see who's going to be drafted by which race. Seated behind me on the stage there are the various representatives, and believe it or not, the blacks have actually won the first pick.
Oh, wow, that's the first lottery a black person's won in a long time, Billy.
Yes, and they'll probably still complain.
Man, f*** you. Well, the black representative is heading to the microphone now. Why don't we take a listen?
Biggest black delegation. Tiger Woods.
No surprises there, fellas. The richest and most dominant athlete in the world. His father, black. His mother, Thai. Well, it doesn't matter anymore because now he is officially black. Dave, the Asians have got to be upset.
There's no question about that, Robert. But you got to think about it. He's been discriminated against in his time. He's had death threats. And he dates a white woman. Oh. Sounds like a black guy to me. Tiger's taking the stage now, and if you ask me,
wow.
Looking blacker already.
I'd like to say it's a tremendous opportunity for me. Finally be part of a race, have a home. Been so confused if I'm Cavalcalesian, so many things. So long, fried rice. Hello, fried chicken. I love you, Dad!
So that's an excerpt of Dave Chappelle's show. Dave, can you talk about what actually happened behind the scenes in writing the sketch, and maybe talk a little first about what happens further into the sketch?
The idea actually was a guy named Brian Tucker submitted the idea of having a racial draft. Finally, races can stop arguing about who is who and definitively label these people once and for all, which was like, you know, that's the heavy lifting. That was a brilliant idea. So Neil's my partner, I write the show with. We sat down and it was like a wealth of jokes that you could do because it's the kind of thing, it's a very race-obsessed culture. You know what I mean? Like when a guy like Vin Diesel becomes famous, there half of the things you'll hear about him is, well, what race is he? And he just doesn't say, which I kind of think is classy. Shooting it was a blast because, we had the Wu-Tang Clan. We had Mos Def playing the black delegate. And that was one of the first sketches we had shot last season, which was kind of like one of those things where, oh, maybe this is going to be a good season. kind of set a good tone for the season that we can kind of go anywhere.
Now, you're really funny at doing white people. And I think, like, when you're white, you don't think of there being, like, a white accent. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
But when I hear you do it, I realize, okay, there's definitely, like, a white accent. So what do you do when you do white?
I take the rhythm out of my voice. I try to keep it monotone and even. But again, all right, see, I do these things. But I'm not really, it's almost like sometimes I watch old movies and how they portray black people, you know, with like Step and Fetch It and all these things. I remember watching them and something in the movie made me laugh and they were like, why are you laughing at that? And it's not that I'm laughing at black people as much as I'm laughing at the way black people were perceived. Like, this is what they actually thought about black people, which just seems ridiculous to me.
Uh-huh.
So I think, you know, when I do that, I think, again, it's not malicious. And it's not necessarily what I think of white people. It's just a funny character of what, you know, what the world looks like through my eyes.
Is there a particular person you conjure up when you do a white man?
Not a particular. It's a composite. It's a composite character.
Of who?
It's funny, man. All right. You know, when I was growing up in D.C., in particular, this isn't true for me personally, but there's a lot of black people that I know who really had never had any personal experience with white people, mm-hmm. which is weird to think about in this day and time. But D.C. is a predominantly black city, and because of the economic situation and whatever, they just didn't have any contact with white people outside of being authority figures. Officer, Your Honor, you know, if it's a teacher or a principal, but it's always some kind of authority figure. So there's this whole, you know, their experience with across the color line normally happened via television or, you know, or something where you're dealing with an authority figure. So I, on the other hand, you know, my parents were split up. My mom was living in D.C. My dad was living in Ohio. I traveled to both places. So I was in the nation's capital on one end. I was in the heartland of America on another. So, you know, I just, culturally, I kind of absorbed a lot. I don't know, man. I got a pretty good understanding about the culture. I think that all these differences are just cultural things.
My guest is Dave Chappelle. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dave Chappelle. His Comedy Central series, Chappelle's Show, features stand-up, sketches, and music. You said in one episode of your show that after someone complained to you that your show was offensive to black people, and that person, by the way, was white, you came up with this idea for a game show called I Know Black People.
I Know Black People!
Welcome to the show, I Know Black People. We take contestants who claim to know black people and put their knowledge of African-American culture to the test. The contestant who answers the most questions, of course, wins our grand prize. Let's bring them out one at a time now. Our first contestant is a professor of African-American studies and history at Fordham University, the New York City police officer, is a writer for such black television shows as The Chris Rock Show and Chappelle Show. Okay, our next contestant works in a Korean grocery store, is a DJ, and claims to have many black... How can black people rise up and overcome?
How can they rise up and overcome? Well, can they? No.
That is correct.
Reparations.
That is acceptable.
This is a rap lyric?
No, this is, I'm sorry.
Oh, this is a general question.
This is an actual question.
All right. There's a complex answer there.
That is correct.
Staying alive.
That is correct. That is correct.
Well, stop cutting each other's throat.
That also is correct. How can black people rise up and overcome?
Get out and vote.
That is incorrect. I'm sorry.
Dave Chappelle, that's such a funny idea for a show. Can you talk a little bit about what happened in the writing of the sketch, like what it was like to put this sketch together?
Originally, we were going to write the material. We were going to write it like an actual sketch. And when we sat down and started to write it, it was one of these things where it's like, this would be better if we got actual people and just quizzed them. And we just came up with questions. We just had them.
You actually got real people. You got like a white cop.
All those people were real. We had them get us a police officer, get us a Korean grocer, get us a black dude.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody. It was completely authentic. And then all the hosting elements were just like as far as those were like off the cuff, you know. But the answers were incredible, man. The things that these people were saying. One of the things, they're going to see me, so they kind of go for being funny, but all of them were really nervous, and they were all kind of afraid that I was making fun of them. And then once we got to shooting, I think everyone just kind of relaxed and kind of unwound. And I don't know. That's one of my favorite sketches we've done.
Now, you grew up in different neighborhoods because I guess this was because of your parents' divorce. If I understand correctly, you grew up in Silver Springs, Maryland, Yellow Springs, Ohio, because your father was teaching at Antioch College, which is located there, and Washington, D.C. You went to schools in these different places, too?
Yeah, I did elementary school in Silver Springs, middle school in Ohio, and high school in Washington.
Were you almost part of, like, different cultures in those different places? Were there different ways of, like, dressing and different music that your friends listened to, depending on which place it was, whether it was the suburbs or the city or Ohio or Washington?
I think elementary school was more integrated because, you know, people were younger. They mixed freely with black kids, white kids. Everybody was, you know, there was no real racial hang-ups in elementary school. And people weren't really clothes conscious because we were young. And then by the time I got to middle school in Ohio, that's when you start seeing alligators on people's sweater and people start getting into, like, status symbols and stuff. And that was the first time where I really started, like, hey, man, I'm poor. And, like, we don't have any money, do we? And then when I got to high school, so then I started getting into clothes. Then I go to high school and, you know, I was gone during middle school. Crack came out while I was gone. So I saw, like, the before and after picture. I had to piece the crack epidemic together. Like, I remember my first day of high school, and they were like, all right, look, if you have a pager on in school, then there's immediate grounds for suspension because we all know what that means. I was in the back like, I don't know what that means. And then, of course, I figured out that and then I was also trying to figure out how everyone had all this, like, gold and expensive stuff. And then I was like, oh, okay, everybody's selling drugs. I knew so many people in the beginning, like my freshman year of high school, that was selling drugs. I can't even imagine how many people were using them. You know, the crack epidemic was crazy, man. And I think a lot of the stuff that I did in my act, just coming from Ohio and then going straight back to D.C. during the crack epidemic, I think that all the inequities were just underlined.
So how did you change as you changed environments?
It's funny, man. When I was in Ohio, I was the first, like, real confident period of my life. Like, I started gaining confidence because for these kids, I was this outsider, and I had to make friends. And that was when I got, like, this huge reputation. Everyone was like, this guy's really funny. I remember in middle school, everyone was just like, this guy Dave is so hilarious. Then when I got to high school and the crack epidemic was out, you know, what it took to be popular during that, I just wasn't willing to do.
Which was what?
You know, sell drugs.
Right.
If you didn't have money, you couldn't get the girl you wanted, you know, it was a crack epidemic. Selling drugs was like a legitimate job in the high school I was going to. And all around D.C. it was like girls like drug dealers because they had money. I wasn't willing to be that. But it was kind of like that context kind of isolated me initially. And then when I started doing stand-up, it was like I thrived all over again.
So when you started doing stand-up and you were still in high school? 14, okay, in Washington. What were the jokes about? What was the humor about?
The first act, Jesse Jackson was running for president, so I used to do jokes about that.
Like what?
I used to talk about stuff I saw on TV, like Alf. But they all had race in them, one way or another. Obviously, Jesse Jackson jokes don't have some racial in them. Alf, my whole thing was like the alien comes 3 billion miles from space and gets a home with a white family. It was the paradox in that joke. Which all sounds corny now, but remember, I was 14, so it was like, wow, well, you know. What else was I talking about? All kinds of stuff. Like in the very beginning, I didn't know that comedians had material. Like I thought they just went up there and would just talk spontaneously. So I used to do the same thing, which is probably better that I started that way. Because that in and of itself is a skill that a lot of comedians are afraid to abandon their act once they get a good amount of time. They just want to stick to it.
So who were your audiences then?
All right, in those days in Washington, again, remember, this is a majority black city. There was no black comedy clubs. And I remember club owners saying things like, we'll never put more than one black person on a show because it offends the audience. I've heard all these things in Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was pretty exclusive. There was one point where they actually had a rule that there was no more cursing on our stage. Which is like, this is in 88. And one of the comics who was black, this is pretty funny, he's like, look, man, he said, I curse. He said, black people use profanity because we live a profane lifestyle. And then he said something that I can't say on the radio. So he's basically like, if you see a roach crawling up the wall, you're not going to be like, golly gee, look at the roaches. You're going to be like, look at this motherfucking roach. You know, you're just gonna go for it. I know you're going to cut that out, but it was really funny, though. But just the fact, thinking back on it, the fact that there was all these limitations and all these weird issues that these club owners had, in one way, maybe prepared me for television.
My guest is Dave Chappelle. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dave Chappelle. His sketch comedy series, Chappelle's Show, is on Comedy Central. When we left off, he was saying that the limitations club owners wanted to put on his act helped prepare him for producers' expectations in broadcast TV.
You know, before I had this show, I'd done 11 television pilots, which was very grueling. You know, it's hard to develop TV, man, especially if you're the youngest guy in the room. And at first, I would defer to these people just because they were older than me and they all had suits on. And I guess they know what they're talking about. But Dave, let me tell you something about TV. People want blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. And our research shows blah, 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 blah. Done that 11 times. You know, each time it got progressively more frustrating. You know, I used to have arguments and all kinds of stuff. And, the last straw, I was developing a show for Fox, and they wanted me to change one of the characters arbitrarily to make the character white. because they felt like it would make the show, the word they used was have a more universal appeal. It's like, okay, you're the universe now? But it was like, it'll give it a more universal appeal. So I quit because at that point I was like, this is an impossible thing to negotiate. There's no way that, I mean, I don't know, you just can't make TV that way. Like, then how do you explain The Cosby Show working? Or how do you explain Will Smith's show working? And there were so many examples of successful shows, and these were considered flukes. Like, they were successful shows with all black cast, and it was considered a total fluke because of some pie chart this guy was holding. And that's when I was like, okay, there's no way I can do this.
I want to ask you another question about having grown up in three different places, suburban Maryland, suburban Ohio, and Washington, D.C.
Rural Ohio.
Suburban
Maryland, rural Ohio, and Washington.
Okay, so that exposes you to different people, different cultures, different kind of geographic landscapes, different ways of living. And I'm wondering if that helped give you the ability to kind of stand back and look at people and see what was kind of funny and ridiculous and absurd about all of us. Do you know what I mean? Because I feel like you have that gift of just looking back and standing outside and looking at everyone and seeing seeing some pretty funny things about us all.
Yeah, because most of the people that are stereotyped, I know the people that the stereotypes are based off of. Like, personally, I've met people like this. You know, I can remember friends of mine growing up, like, we used to all play football after school and be like, it's four of us was black. Two of us was Vietnamese. It was a Jewish guy from the Deep South. it was an eclectic group, you know, but we all got along. We all, you know, were friends. In the household I grew up in, my parents were somewhat, I don't know how to explain it, but over our mantelpiece, there was pictures of Malcolm X. You know, I listened to Dick Gregory records growing up. I listened to The Last Poets. I mean, you know, there were books all over the house, and always reading stuff. So like, you know, like people like Frederick Douglass, I you know, these guys' pictures were on my walls when I was growing up.
You described your family growing up as the broke Huxtables.
Yeah, we were like broke Huxtables.
Your mother was is a Unitarian minister?
She was, yeah. She was, I believe she was the first black woman ordained in that Unitarian church.
And your father was a music professor.
Yeah.
What kind of music?
Voice. He used to sing opera and stuff.
So your family was really very educated and probably instilled those values in you. Was there pressure on you to do well in school and what you really wanted was to be a comic?
I mean, first of all, I was a horrible student. My parents, you know, my dad was very philosophical about these kind of things. As a matter of fact, when I'm the first person in my family not to go to college, like since slavery. And my grandmother, my mother's mother, didn't like that at all. She, at first, because I was 17, I'm like, I'm not going to college. I'm going to move to New York and try to make it in stand-up. And she kind of flipped out. She was like, it's a dream of mine. This is a heavy guilt trip. She goes, it's a dream of mine to see all of my grandbabies graduate from college before I die. It's like, why you got to bring Diane up, man? And that's a lot of pressure. But then my dad's whole take on it was, unless you want to do something that requires you go to college, then college could very well be a waste of your time.
And he was a college professor, so coming from him, that must have really registered on you.
He was an educator. He was an educated man. And I think my parents ultimately wanted me to be happy. You know, I mean, my argument was, you know, Dad, if you're making a teacher's salary, if I can make a teacher's salary doing stand-up, to me, I'd rather do that than teach. It's like, and he understood where I was coming from. Like, you know, it's like I didn't necessarily have to be rich and famous. Obviously, I wanted to, but that wasn't necessarily my aim. I just really, 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 to this day, I really like doing stand-up.
Since you started when you were so young, your mother had to... Did she have to or did she just want to come to the clubs with you? Was that required as, like, an official chaperone because you were underage?
Originally, she had to. Once everyone started knowing me, this was kind of like our routine. We'd meet down at the club. I'd be coming from school. She'd be coming from work. It was cool, man. It was like a good way to spend time together. And then at a certain age, like maybe a year into it, you know, she'd get tired at night. We'd both burn the candle both ends, but I'd always want to go, so she just let me go. And you know, not until I'm an adult, then she tells me how scary that was for her.
In what way?
You know? I mean, she tells stories like she'd hear gunshots in the middle of the night. And, you know, she went, oh, my God, it's my baby. All right. I mean, remember, this is D.C. during the crack epidemic. But I guess in her mind, it's like of all the bad things that my child could be doing, he just wants to tell jokes at these clubs. And it was a controlled environment for me. It's not like the bartender's going to give me drinks. I'm 14. It's, you know, everyone kind of looked out for me. It wasn't like I saw stuff going on, but not really. It was really goal-oriented, the time I was spending there.
Well, Dave Chappelle, thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
All right. No problem. It was good to meet you.
Dave Chappelle recorded last September. Tonight, Comedy Central will run 6 episodes of Chappelle's show back to back. Our end of the year series, Last Laughs, concludes tomorrow. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we conclude our end-of-the-year series, Last Laughs. We'll hear from Blues Brother, Conehead, Ghostbuster, and all-around wild and crazy guy, Dan Aykroyd. Also, a tribute to Fats Waller, featuring guitarist and singer Marty Gross and cornetist Randy Reinhardt. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.